and I work with Dr. Latrina Frazier in long-term care, and we just want to welcome you to our long-term care provider call this afternoon, and thank you so much for joining us and spending some time. Just a couple of reminders, all calls are muted, and this session is being recorded. We will have a Q&A session towards the end of the call, and we ask that you hold your questions until that time. Also, as a reminder, you're able to contact us at the following phone number with any questions or any information that you might have for us, and that is area code 405-271-6868, or you can send an email to ltc@health.ok.gov. And those are two good methods to get in touch with us if you need to. We also want to remind you that the recorded session will be posted on our webpage, and the address for that website is ltc.health.ok.gov. And when you look on the left-hand side, you'll see LTC COVID-19 resources, and Diane Henry is our webmaster, and she posts all of the recordings, the FAQs. She'll also post some notes regarding this meeting and any other resources that we feel like are important for you to have. So to start us off today, we have Dr. Latrina Frazier, and she's going to take us through some general updates and some basic information. Dr. Frazier?
Thank you, Beverly. Good afternoon, everyone. As Beverly stated, thank you for joining us for this call. I'm going to start with a couple of updates. The first thing that I would like to let you know is that Mike Cook is no longer with the State Department of Health. Please know that you can still contact long-term care with the same numbers and information that Beverly provided. We will work to get all of your questions answered and to make sure that you have a timely response. With that, I'm going to move into the agenda, and the first thing is the Binex Now and CLIA. What I want to remind you is that if you have a current CLIA certificate of waiver, that waiver has to be updated to reflect the Binex Now, if that is a system that you are using. If you have possibly already added maybe the BD Veritor, the Quidel Sophia, or any other point of care antigen rapid testing machine, each platform has to be added to your certificate. Now, when I say that, I don't want you to think that you are going to receive a certificate by mail, that there's going to be a line that clearly reflects this. It just has to be identified in CLIA that you are authorized to use this testing platform. As we begin to transition, this is going to be very important, because long-term care, if you are needing assistance, possibly with outbreak testing, that BD, that Binex Now is going to be important to be added to your CLIA. That will help you not to have delays in your testing. The other thing, if you are a facility, we have been working with a lot of the assisted living facilities, and you are working to get a CLIA certificate of waiver, I want to share with you that one of the things that HHS disseminated this week was that all assisted living and nursing homes that have CLIA certificates of waivers will be provided some testing, and it is expected that they are going to distribute Binex Now. So when you have that certificate of waiver, the CLIA department is actively updating information, so you are in queue to hopefully receive some testing, point of care tests. I do not have a timeline to that, and I know long-term care does not, so the CLIA and the long-term care staff do not. As information evolves, we will be sure to let you know. But with that being said, I'll move on past CLIA. The next thing is the resident case investigations are being handled by the long-term care team. So anytime there is a case in your facility and it has to do with a resident, long-term care is going to be your first point of touch that will help with walking through that contact. When it comes to your staffing, of course, long-term care is also going to be engaged in that, but you will find that it will primarily be handled by the county due to your staff not always being in your facility and them possibly having outside contacts. So I think that is all that I have, and I will turn it back over to Beverly.
Latrina, thank you very much. Janine, I'll pass it over to you.
Thanks, Beverly. Okay, so a couple of items to kind of talk about. The 283 form that you all are filling out to send in on the communicable disease side, that's kind of where COVID fits. We're looking at streamlining that process a bit for you all since their definition is a little bit different for an outbreak outside of flu, like any respiratory illness or GI illness that you need at least three in that 72-hour time frame. Since COVID is one that triggers the outbreak, and you all have been sending those in, we're going to try and reduce some of that process, the number of phone calls coming in and things like that. So just kind of stay tuned. There are several different moving parts that we're still ironing out, but just kind of be on the lookout. The 283 forms, those actually now are kind of filtering across to me in HAI. And in reviewing some of these, everyone's kind of doing things a little bit different. Some of those things can be challenging. So when you're sending these in, kind of look them over to make sure if you are reusing something with some pre-populated dates that you change the dates. Some of those have been inconsistent from the incident date at the top and then all of the things that are kind of typed into the bottom. So just kind of review that process and make sure that your information in there is accurate so that we can kind of best help on the HAI side in making phone calls to you if it kind of triggers that you all are having some questions or concerns and in the documentation. Along that lines, I'm still seeing a decent amount of confusion regarding isolation and quarantine. Isolation is the time frame of 10 days or up to 20 days for someone who is immunosuppressed to be on transmission-based precautions or away from work if it is a staff member. I like to say quarantine is 14. They rhyme. So quarantine is your post-exposure, your unknown individuals after an exposure. It's always 14 days. That will not change. There seems to be a lot of return to work. They're sending staff home to quarantine for 14 days after a positive test. Don't lose your staff for any longer than you have to once they've met that recovery definition based off of the time-based, symptom-based strategy for return to work or removal from transmission-based precautions. For those of you that may have corporate procedures, policies in place to where you are requiring negative PCR testing to come back, that's an important thing to kind of include on your 283s. That way there's some awareness that's kind of what you're doing. There have been a lot of instances where you're maybe only requiring one tests to return to work after they've completed their 10 to 20 days. Just be aware that that's not necessarily in line with the CDC. Of course, they don't recommend testing for that recovery. So some of the information that's coming across in these 283s are getting very intertwined and may be posing a challenge for you to remove residents from transmission-based precautions in your COVID unit, in turn making it difficult should you have new positives and need to find space. So kind of review your COVID plan and your process for your COVID unit and all of those things that kind of fall into place just to really kind of make sure that your additional planning that may need to be in place if you outgrow your COVID unit based off of what your process may be, that you have those alternatives in place. There were, in the month of October, several updates to the CDC guidelines on the infection control sections. In particular, your strategies for optimizing the supply of PPE, your eye protection and gloves, they added some considerations for returning to your conventional capacity practices, which basically goes back to the standard of practice, changing eye protection between every person, discarding, et cetera, based off of your supply. They also spoke to, and I think I brought this up early in October when they brought it out, was the strategy for optimizing the supply of isolation gowns. They added considerations to utilize your reusable, washable, or cloth isolation gowns, moving those to conventional capacity so that you are able to return to those practices where you have enough supply. You can change in between. You don't have to extend wear. This helps reduce any additional concerns for spread or contamination of the general environment that staff is working in a COVID cohort. They did edit some of the sections regarding coveralls and some of the language on prioritizing the use. So if you haven't had a chance, if you pop into the strategies for optimizing PPE, you'll find in the top box the snippets of kind of what they changed. But go in and kind of be familiar. Dr. Fraser covered the point of care testing CLIA piece. They did add a new webpage on point of care testing. Guidance for SARS-CoV-2 point-of-care testing. There are two pieces to that that I would recommend that you go look at. The one is how to safely perform the point-of-care specimen collection, handling, and testing for COVID-19. Be sure if you're doing a mid-turbinate collection or an anterior NAERS that they are being collected properly for the test that you're performing. And make sure that, you know, the compliance with the result reporting is occurring. So those are some of the pieces on that new page that I would encourage you to look at as part of once you have your CLIA certificate waiver in place and are doing that point of care testing for the different tests that you've received. And I think that's all I have.
Okay. Denise, thank you very, very much. We also have joining us this afternoon is Lavetta Abdullah, and she's going to talk about the Civil Monetary Penalty Reinvestment Fund. Mm-hmm. Lavetta, go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. As Beverly stated, I'm Lavetta Abdullah, the program manager.
Lavetta? Lavetta, can you hear me?
I've lost her.
Oh. We have temporarily lost Lavetta on the call. I'm going to call Sherry Longacre, and Sherry, we'll give you a call, and you can share your information next. Sherry, it's Beverly. I'm going to put you on.
Oh, perfect.
All right. Sherry Longacre is with a QIN, QIO, Telegen, and she's going to provide you with an update.
Thank you, Beverly, for having me on the call today. And hi, everyone. My name is Sherry Longacre, and I'm the Senior Quality Improvement Facilitator here at Telegen, and we are the QIN, QIO, the Quality Improvement Organization for the state of Oklahoma. Telegen is partnering with our nursing homes on the two CMS initiatives, including the CMS COVID-19 Targeted Referral Quality Improvement Initiative, which we call the QII, and the CMS Healthy Communities Nursing Home Initiative as well. We are receiving our QIIs, our Quality Improvement Initiative referrals from CMS every week. And these referrals from CMS are to assist with the infection prevention and control program, where we help to identify the gaps and to provide a plan for improvement. They are time sensitive, and the QII plans do have to be submitted within 30 days to CMS. So if we are calling you, please call us back. We also share lots of tools and resources, and we recently added a compendium of the testing and reporting requirements for nursing homes, and also a flu resource guide as well. So please check those resources out also. Telegen continues to provide assistance with NHSN and troubleshooting, so please reach out. As we know, new guidance was released, and NHSN is sending out the invites to upgrade your NHSN access from level 1 to level 3. They are currently holding trainings and sending out those invites, so just look for those as well. And also, just a little helpful hint that I think I share every time, so please forgive me. But please just make sure that more than one person has access to your NHSN. So if there is an illness or staff turnover, you will always have a backup and be able to submit your data weekly. Because unfortunately, there are penalties that occur when your data is not reported timely. And that is so important. And we're seeing a lot of that in the past couple of weeks. We also have a few upcoming learning opportunities that I'd like to share. Due to the need, we have a weekly root cause analysis class, and we also added a PDSA class for additional trainings for your team. Those, you do not have to register way in advance or anything. You can just register and pop into those classes. And we also have our long-term care office hours, which will be on November 19th at 2 p.m., and we're going to have Dr. Leah Watson as our guest speaker. And she's going to discuss the importance of just recognizing COVID fatigue and how to manage chronic stress as well. Since Telegen is the Quality Improvement Organization for the state of Oklahoma, I would like to invite you to access the Telegen website at telegenqinqio.com to check out our upcoming events. And this just kind of connects us together and allows you to have access to tools and resources and educational opportunities. And if you need assistance, please just reach out to me. You can shoot me an email at slongacre@telegen.com, or my office number is 405-810-3224. With that, I'll turn it back over to you, Beverly. Thank you so much, and have a great day, everyone.
Sherry, thank you very much. We appreciate it. All the information that you provide and the services that you provide to our long-term care facilities. I think we have Lavetta back, and again, she's talking about the Civil Monetary Penalty Reinvestment Fund. Lavetta?
Hello, everyone. I apologize that we got disconnected earlier. Again, the contact information is 651, that's area code 405-651-817, And our email address is cmp@health.ok.gov. You should have received notifications that we're accepting application for visitation aid as a result of QSO 20-39, I believe. You can go to our, we're issuing up to $1,500 per facility. Facility is defined as those certified, those homes certified to participate in Title 18 and 19 of the Social Security Act. You can get applications and more information on our website, and our website is cmp.health.ok.gov. And we're still accepting applications for technology and accessories up to $2,000 per facility. Again, you can go to our website at cmp.health.ok.gov to get the applications and other details. And finally, we're still talking about payments for the technology. The quick answer is, if you're concerned about the status of your facility, give me an email or a call. But I do want you to know that I did have a meeting with a meeting set up with financial services on Monday to see what was taking so long, because I'm getting emails from facilities I should not be getting emails from. But they had to reschedule it to this Friday at about 1 o'clock p.m. So as soon as I get information, I'll email all the facilities individually. But again, you can contact me as well. I want everyone to know that the state of Oklahoma statewide accounting system will be down from November the 6th until November the 11th. So no payments will be processed during that time frame. You know, it doesn't matter if the CMP, CARES Act, whatever. Probably not even for your Medicaid payments. Because that's a statewide system. So that's November the 6th through November the 11th. Just wanted you to know that. And again, please call me at 651-8179 or email me at cmp@health.ok.gov for more information. Thank you for your time today.
Lavetta, thank you very, very much. Again, we'll be posting this information on our webpage. So Lavetta's contact information will be part of the posting that we have, so you'll have that there. Our next presenter will be Paula Carroll. She's our manager of survey, and she's going to update you on survey deficiency concerns. Paula?
Hi. We're continuing to conduct COVID-focused surveys at facilities. So I looked at the ones we've done since the last time we had a call, which was about 3 weeks ago. These are the concerns that we've identified during that time frame. We saw issues with screening residents for COVID-19 signs and symptoms, some issues with how positive residents are being cohorted, problems with not wearing appropriate PPE in COVID units or with quarantine residents, some issues with proper use of PPE, including not wearing surgical masks appropriately, not conducting outbreak testing when you have positive staff or residents, disinfecting with solutions that were not appropriate, using proper hand hygiene, and staff screening. And that's it. That's all I have.
Paula, thank you very, very much. Dr. Frazier, before we move into our Q&A session, I wanted to check back with you and see if you had any additional information or thoughts that you would like to share.
I think, Beverly, at this point, I'll wait to see what questions come up, and hopefully those will trigger some thoughts for me, but I'll wait. I don't want to overwhelm anyone with what's in my head, so I'll wait to see what questions come up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank each of our presenters today. We will move into our Q&A session, and if you'll give me a moment, I'll activate the Q&A session, and you'll be given some guidance on how to ask your questions.
This conference is now in question and answer mode. To alert the speaker that you have a question, press 1, then 0.
Go ahead, caller. Ask your question.
Well, I'm calling because I have some concerns about the COVID-19 vaccine that is in the process, according to my emails from the Oklahoma State Department of Health Immunization Program, fixing to be shipped to our residents and staff. I have already have staff that it said if they are requested to take the vaccine, they will quit. And I've already had residents' families who have called who have said, you're not giving that vaccine to my mother. So how do we proceed with this vaccine situation?
Dr. Frazier?
Yes, I was going to say, Beverly, I can take that. At this point, the state of Oklahoma, we are in the planning phase. One of the things that we have recognized that there is a lot of information being put out there, and I do want to reassure everyone that we are in the planning phases of this. There will be communication, there will be discussion that occurs with you, with your facility, and as the providers, we understand that, you know, there are constraints to everything as far as distribution, as far as administration of the vaccine. So I want you to know that you do have long-term care representation in OSDH on those calls, and I will actually carry this information forward, but this has been discussed, and they continue to discuss. So we are definitely aware that this is not a blanket one-size-fits-all approach to the vaccination. So thank you for that.
Okay, and then I have a question. I received an email from Camilla Garcia, an immunization team specialist, about registering as a pandemic vaccination provider. Now, initially, our facility got a call and said, you have to register as a pandemic vaccination provider and be able to give this vaccination to the community in order to get COVID-19 vaccinations for your nursing home residents. Well, since then, we have received emails and been instructed that we can enroll through NSHN for CVS to be that vaccination provider, and then we do not have to do all of this additional reporting and agreements and other requirements. NSHN has said on that when you do their page, it says you're free from all of that because your provider is CVS. So I responded to this email and I asked for an explanation of, you know, I don't want to give to the community. We only signed up with this to get vaccinations for our residents. Do you have any clarification on that immunization team department on this email?
Well, I will say I was on a call yesterday, and you are correct. CVS and Walgreens do have contracts. They are supposed to be set up to administer or to take care of the vaccination from beginning to end. I do recommend that you reach back to the OSDH team that is taking care of the vaccination, that immunization program area, because they can clarify and clear up any misconceptions or to actually hear from you. It may help them to tailor their communication going forward. So I do recommend that you reach back out to them.
I will
relay this, but as far as the vaccination goes, we are still in the planning phases, and of course that distribution date is a best-case scenario based on the planning that the state has been doing in conjunction with our federal partners.
So, and when you say planning stages, are you also referring to the fact that there hasn't been any guidance put out stating that healthcare workers, nursing home employees have to be vaccinated to maintain their jobs or to work with the general population?
Correct.
Okay.
right. Thank you very much for your question. Caller, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I had a couple of questions. One, we had just recently received this shipment of N95, but they look like the KN95, but they are N95, so it's a one size fits all. So do we still have to do the fit testing on those since it's a one size fit all?
Janine, do you have some thoughts?
So where did these N95 ship from? Is it something that you ordered or?
Yes, it was something that we ordered. They're in individual packages. It says that it's an N95, not a KN95. It looks like a KN95, but it says it's an N95. And then I looked on the internet and there are N95s that are shaped like this. It's like the duck bill, but it's one size fits all. So we've been fit testing them, but I was wondering, you know, do we have to since it's a one size fits all?
So fit testing is for to meet your OSHA requirements. You need to be fit tested to guarantee that a provider is protected with the PPE that you provide them for use. I have a concern with anything that says one size fits all because when that happens, nothing fits me, especially when it comes to something that's respiratory protection. The only way you can cross over any type of N95 mask after fit testing if it is by the same manufacturer. And the design of the mask is the same. That's kind of the only caveat to that. So if you have not been fit tested for a duckbill and a one-size-fits-all, that to me makes me wonder if this is a healthcare grade or more of a commercial grade type mask. So I would recommend investigating that a little bit more, but I would have a concern to provide a false sense of security for a mask that may be no more protective than a surgical mask when you're not fit tested.
Okay, so we've been fit testing them. So we'll just continue on.
Hold on one second. Dr. Frazier, okay. Do you have something you'd like to add?
I was just going to say I definitely agree with Janine with the mask because of it being a duck bill, it may not be the best fit for everyone, and it is recommended that you test for that to be a safe mask for your staff that are going to wear it.
Okay. Okay. And then I had another question, if I may, and this is on testing. We're on twice-a-week testing currently because of our percent positivity in our county. Our hospice people who are here on a regular basis, they come in every week, they have to be tested twice a week also, just as if they were our staff, right? If they're here on a regular basis.
So they're considered contracts, correct?
They are considered contracts, but there is a little description in here of what staff is. It includes employees, consultants, contractors, volunteers, and caregivers who provide care and services to residents on behalf of the facility. So I think it does include them.
And I don't know if Dr. Frazier wants to chime in. I know this has kind of been a question. They need to be tested, and they need to provide those results if their employer is doing that. But since they are hospice, I'm not sure. Dr. Frazier, can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, this has been a discussion that's been occurring in the acute care area just because the guidance is a little wonky. but what I would say is that these are your partners. these are people who, like you said, are in and out of your facility, and it is an expectation that you have that communication of what their testing practices are and what they look like, because they're your partners in caring for your resident, their patient. Let me carry that to CMS just so that we can make sure we get you a clear answer. We have asked before, but we know that, like I said, with the acute care setting, some of the information has not been the same. So let me just say, before I give you something that may not be 100%, I'd rather carry it forward. And if you will send us an email, we'll make sure that we get that directly to you, but we'll also make sure that we get a response out to everyone else.
Okay. And then can I ask just one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
When you have somebody in isolation, the unknowns, they're not COVID positive, we have been told in the past, but I just wanted to clarify, you do not have to wear the gown if you're not actually providing direct care, like if you're giving them their medicine, say, and you're not touching them. Do you have to wear a gown?
So all of that is based upon your mitigation strategies, your optimization of your PPE. If you have reusable gowns that can be removed and washed and a new gown go on, ideally, yes, you should go back to conventional practices as if you are fully supplied. If you are at that point of your contingency or crisis strategy management and you do not have gowns, then you prioritize by task what would be required for gown use. So if you're looking at a medication, if you have a resident that is an aspiration risk and you have to crush their medication up and feed it to them, I would want to wear a gown, because if there was choking or sputtering or anything like that, your provider's protected. If you're handing over meds from a souffle cup for a resident that is fairly self-sufficient, then no, as long as there's not going to be significant contact with the individual or their environment. But again, you have to know what you have on hand, your burn rate, and those sorts of things in order to determine what your practices need to be to preserve your PPE.
So you can use a cloth gown then that's washable?
Yes, you can. And that was, I'm not sure if you joined the call and heard, they did do some updates to your optimization of PPE use and strategies. So on the CDC website for long-term care, for infection control, on that sidebar, if you pull up the optimization strategies, you'll find that information there about the cloth gowns now being considered normal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Did y'all have any?
Caller, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I wanted to find out on the waiver, CLIA waiver, if you are doing rapid testing, like say a patient has some symptoms or a staff member comes in and has tests, symptoms, and you use the Abbott one, will your CLIA waiver cover that?
If you're referring to the, such as the Abbott ID Now, anything like that, that is by FDA authorized as a wave testing. It will, as long as you have also identified it as a testing mechanism for your facility.
Okay, so if you have to, like if you have the VD machine, or you do the other one, which is not a machine, it's just droplets, you know, you have the... you know, it's on, like, paper?
The card, yes, ma'am.
It's a card, I'm sorry, a card. So the card would need to go through the waiver, too.
Yes, the card is the Binex Now, and it is a waived test, and it is what you will hear is an FDA emergency use authorization waived test. So because of that EUA status, it requires that it be completed with those authorized to complete waived testing.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Caller, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. One of them is you test an employee on Tuesday. You're on once-a-week testing. You test an employee on Tuesday. Then Wednesday they become symptomatic. And then so they're going to be off for 10 days based on symptom-based strategy. Symptom is elevated temp, 100 degrees. So they're going to be off based on symptom-based strategy. But then when they come back and they test again, there's a chance that they'd be positive. So then do we start them on another 10-day quarantine? Because we don't know if that first set of symptom-based time they were off was actually COVID or not. Or how does that work?
So when you're doing routine testing and you have a staff member or a resident even that tests negative, but the next day they develop symptoms, you should test them again. Your test is only a point in time, and we do see that pre-symptomatic stage where individuals are not going to show up necessarily positive, especially on the antigen testing, because it has to be able to pick up. It's much more significant, if you will, if someone is symptomatic. So you never want to ignore the onset of symptoms. You should also perhaps consider that we still have other respiratory illnesses that cause fever or GI illnesses. So if, you know, it's the case, it could be strep, it could be flu, both of which are treatable, and potentially if that's the diagnosis, they can return to work a bit on a different time frame. With the COVID positive, especially if you are in outbreak testing, that's an even bigger concern if someone were to develop symptoms after they tested negative and were asymptomatic. So it's always important to test somebody who becomes symptomatic regardless of what even previous day testing could have demonstrated. If you choose to have them off and suspect them of having COVID, then in the CDC guidelines, if you do not test them but they have a considered diagnosis of these type of symptoms, you would not retest for the 90 days that they could potentially be shedding. So it would be based off of how that diagnosis was made, whether it was test or by symptoms. So you don't want to retest the previous positive within that first 90 days. Unless, of course, there's been, again, outbreak, exposure, and symptom onset again. And then, additionally, you want to rule out other things before you would repeat a COVID test.
Okay, so let me ask this question, too, based on what you just said. So if we test the person and they're negative, and then we wait 24 hours and retest them again and they're negative. Do those have to be PCR tests, or can they test two negatives 24 hours apart and return to work after that? Because that's scary to me.
So if you have someone who has tested positive,
No, I'm talking about negative. They test negative.
If they test negative and are symptomatic, yes, you should follow that with a PCR to ensure that it's not a false negative. If that PCR is positive, there you go. If it is negative, then other etiologies should be investigated following your return to work criteria for respiratory, GI, fever, whatever that illness may be suspect of. The two negative tests done 24 hours apart should only be done if you are trying to return a positive individual back to work before their isolation time frame of 10 or 20 days has not occurred.
Okay, and then if a new thing came up where the tester, one of the testers that does the clerical part of the testing, tested positive during the testing, and then because she had been in the same room with the tester for more than 15 minutes, the tester now is on 14-day quarantine as well. And is that something new, or is that something that should just be happening, or is it confusion because they were 6 feet apart, both in full PPE, and now the tester is off on 14-day quarantine too, as a recommendation by the team leader of the people we have to report stuff to?
So there's a couple of instances there that you would look at. If for staffing mitigation, this is someone who needs to be in your facility and they remain asymptomatic and you're continuing to do your outbreak testing now at that point, it is allowable for them to work under the staffing mitigation. It's always the recommendation if someone has been exposed that they be off if that is feasible. So you, again, need to make that determination. The county health departments also, when they look at contact tracing with staff, those are the initial recommendations that they make as well, unless it falls under the staffing mitigation.
Okay, but it wouldn't be that the person, the tester, if they were testing somebody in general and they hadn't been in any more contact with them than doing the test and they're wearing PPE, otherwise your tester, anytime they test somebody positive, is off for 14 days, and so nobody wants to be the tester if that's the case.
They wouldn't have met the 15 minutes.
No, but
okay, so that's the kicker, is if they test somebody positive, it doesn't matter unless they're in extended contact with that person.
Caller, we'd like for you to call us, and we'd like to visit with you offline and maybe go through some different scenarios. Would that be okay with you?
Sure. When can I call that somebody will answer?
I'll tell you, if you'll send an email to the ltc@health.ok.gov, it will go to Paula Terrell, and just give us your name, the facility name, and your phone number, and Paula will give you a call. And that email address go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I have Paula's. I'll just send it to Paula.
Okay.
I have Paula's email.
Send it to Paula. She's shaking her head yes. So, yes. Thank you so very much. Great questions. So, thank you.
Thanks.
Caller, go ahead with your question.
Hi, I have actually a couple of questions. My first question is, if we receive a positive test result on a rapid COVID test for an employee, do we report it now or do we wait until we receive confirmation from a PCR test? The reason I'm asking that is at one time I was told that we do not report a positive rapid test until we have a confirmed positive test for a PCR test. That's my first question.
I think you report it. The requirements are that you report within like 24 hours. So you would need to report that before you got your confirmatory PCR back. You can put in your incident report that you did a PCR and are waiting on the confirmatory result.
Okay.
and you still need to treat that individual as though they're positive and restrict them from work until you get that confirmation. And that way, if they are positive, they have not truly exposed additional folks for any length of time.
Okay, so yes, of course, we've quarantined that person, and the report has been made for Fido, Qualtrics, but not the, you know, 283, the state, the or the local health department. So, does that, when would we go into outbreak testing then, if we got a confirmed PCR test then, and not because of a rapid?
First of all, you do submit the 283. We want you to submit that 283.
Right.
If you were in, was this a resident or an employee?
Employee.
Okay, so if you're just doing routine testing,
yes,
then you can wait until you get that confirmatory PCR to initiate your outbreak testing.
I will tag on to that. However, if that is an individual that was assigned to a particular hallway, you could institute PPE use and quarantine those residents until that confirmatory comes back as well. And that way, if it does initiate outbreak testing, you've hopefully provided some mitigation to at least that hallway or the residents that were potentially exposed to that staff member.
Okay.
So all the mitigation prevention strategies should still be put into place. The only thing that, as Paula stated, if you wanted to hold off on that confirmatory PCR for sure that person has to stay off work and initiate testing of everybody else, but put the other mitigation strategies into place as soon as possible as that prevention measure.
Okay. And then what if, and this is the what if, you test a vendor because the reports also state that, you know, we're required to test vendors, and if they happen to test positive, because normally I would just send that person home and wouldn't allow them in the facility.
Well, yeah, if you tested the vendor and they were positive, you would certainly want to exclude them from your facility.
Right. Okay. Then we have one more question.
One moment. I think Dr. Frazier would like to pipe in.
I have a question. So with the vendor, once you test them, and this is from a CLIA perspective, they become your patient. So I just want to make sure, because I heard you say that you're testing them and you just send them home, I want to make sure that you're still reporting that result.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
I believe you had another question.
Yes, we're trying to get our temporary nurse aides certified now, and we're doing all the training here and we're doing the paperwork, but I'm faxing that paperwork over to the state so they can get their letter to test, but I can't get a hold of anybody. I faxed, but I'm not getting any information back. I've tried to call, nobody will call me back, and I've been trying for probably 6-7 weeks just to talk to somebody on what to do.
Can I ask if you would send that to me? This is Dr. Frazier. If you would email me, I know that staff has been in the process of moving, which has made access to things such as faxing disjointed for them, but if you will email that to me, if you're able to email that,
I am.
I would be happy to relay that and get this resolved for you.
Dr. Frazier, do you want them to email you directly, and if so, do you want to provide your email address, or do you want them to email the long-term care?
No, email me directly on that. My email address is Latrina, LATRINAF, as in Frazier, at help, HEALTH, .ok.gov.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'll watch for that.
Caller, did you have any other questions?
No, we're good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Caller, go ahead with your question.
I have two questions. First of all, NHSN, we received emails stating that we needed level 3 access to start reporting all of our test results in there. Will those reports be coming back to FIDO and CLIA on a state level?
Can you repeat the last portion of that?
Will the reports from NHSN be sent back to CLIA and FIDO?
At this point, that answer, just in short, is no. It does not mean that we are not working on that. There are a couple of things in motion, as Janine mentioned earlier, where we are looking at every opportunity to streamline for you all. So I do not have a change at this point, but we are hopeful.
Okay. One other question on our point of care testing, are we ever going to have to do proficiency testing on those tests? That's a CLIA question.
So every machine has manufacturer's instructions that address cleaning, quality checks for your machine. I highly recommend that you look at those manufacturer's instructions because they tell you exactly what is expected for that machine. I also recommend that you have it documented when you've done those things according to the manufacturer's instructions.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Caller, go ahead with your question.
Thank you. The question I have we're not required to do the CNA testing right now. We don't have the 14 days right now, correct? That's still extended with the governor's order, or are we in the process of that 14 days to hurry up and get everybody tested now for the iCNAs or the student CNAs or whatever people are calling them?
You are correct. We do not have the 14 days. I do recommend if you have staff and they have completed all of the training and are ready to test, we recommend that, and just to let you know that you are able to do the testing. You don't have to wait until the end of the executive order.
Okay. All right. And I understand that piece. I just want to make sure I hadn't missed something. Thank you.
No, I think you got it.
Thank you, caller. Caller, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, my question is a lab person considered a vendor?
Dr. Frazier?
I'm assuming when you say lab person, you're speaking to maybe your reference lab that comes in and collects specimen to take for testing?
They come in to collect labs, yeah, like A1Cs, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
If they test positive, do we have to report that on the Q83?
If you are the tester,
yes.
You would have to report that. A lab person would be considered a vendor possibly if you have a contract. Of course, they're contracted.
Okay.
They may be a contractor.
Okay, so we're reporting the positive on a FIDO, but we also need to report it on the Q83, correct?
Two.
Or I'm sorry,
two.
283.
Yes.
Okay, and the same with family members, if we're having visitation, if a family member is positive, we report those as well.
Yes, you would want to report those, and let me explain why, because that is a community member that will probably have to be contacted out to the counties, and it just gives the information. I'll defer to Paula in reference to the other pieces, but this is why it's important to report on a grander scale.
Yes, I agree, since they're doing the testing and it's someone who's probably in their facility frequently, that I would, yeah. And then, of course, it get reported into FIDO and everything, too, so the contact tracing.
They didn't get PCR, did they?
No, it was just an antigen.
Like that.
It was done with the BDV Veritor and became positive, and then we referred her to do a PCR, but we haven't received the PCR testing yet, results on her.
You would still report the positive.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So they just told us two different things in the same phone call.
Thank you okay. very much.
Thank you.
We'll just go ahead and start the interview.
We appreciate all of the questions we have received today. I'm going to look around to my presenters and see if, based on the questions we've had, if they have any other information they would like to share. And Dr. Frazier, I'll start with you. Is there anything else you would like to share before we end our call today?
Thanks, Beverly. I just, again, like Beverly said, want to thank you for joining us. The one thing that we've realized, I think everyone in the room, is that these calls are really for the providers, and we're hoping that we're giving information that is pertinent to your needs and to your questions. If you have a specific topic that you would like for us to address, or for us to have a detailed discussion about, would you please just send that to the long-term care email and just address it as provider calls, and let us know what your primary questions and struggles are, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Dr. Frazier, thank you very much. Janine, I think you have something you'd like to add.
I just wanted to make sure for any of you that are currently on the call, if you have called into acute disease to report positives or update and you have not received a call back, Kim has not been in the office, is my understanding.
No power,
yeah. So, I will be honest with you, I have not tried to inundate you with phone calls from the acute disease side. If you were merely calling to report, I did not acknowledge that you called. If, however, you've called and left a message requesting any sort of assistance or an actual callback, I am working through those. So if when you call you need to speak with one of the epidemiologists or with me, when you leave that message, ask for a callback. Otherwise, you know, just kind of what you've been doing that you're just reporting, I will likely not call you back, nor will an epi. So just kind of be aware of that. We are receiving your calls, so don't panic that you're looking for a confirmation that we've gotten it. Those have been coupled with your 283s that are coming in. So I haven't heard of any issues there on that side. So that's all I have.
Janine, thank you very much. I want to remind you of the phone number and the email address that you can contact us with, and we encourage you to reach out with any questions that you may have or if you're looking for information. Again, our phone number is area code 405-271-6868, or you can send an email to ltc@health.ok.gov. Again, we appreciate so much your time and participation in our call this afternoon, and I hope you and your staff and families are safe and well. Talk to you soon. Bye.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.